Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Your Honor, I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
I did, you know, the murders, but as you're all so looking forward to this, I thought I'd plead not guilty. Oh.
They say a man who represents himself has a fool for a client. Well, with God as my witness, I am that fool.
Mr. Simpson, this is the most blatant case of fraudulent advertising since my suit against the film The Neverending Story.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 165. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Out over there is your lawyerly host, Andrew Torres. We can breathe. We're not trying to cram in 478 different indictments and nonsenses in here.
It's true, right? Like, let's keep this on a strict schedule. But I mean, there were a dozen stories that I wanted to cover on last Friday's episode, and it just until we go to, you know, daily shows. That's,
oh my gosh,
we're gonna have to try and cherry pick and give you the stuff you need to get through your week. But
all right, well, we've got a great episode for you today. As we alluded to last week, we're gonna be talking about we're gonna be doing some follow ups. Some of the cases that Andrew has educated us on throughout the past, year. We'll see how far back these go. But follow-ups and where they went and what the implications are. It's going to be fun. A little bit of nostalgia, but with a with an update on all them and what we've learned from them. So with that said, we also need to note that this episode pretty much has to have the explicit tag because not to give anything away, not because, you know, you and I are going to curse willy-nilly, but because there's a certain case that involves profanity and there's not really a good way to talk about it without being profane. So yep, that's going to happen, but it's for an educational purpose. It's not just for us blowing off steam.
I swear for two reasons and two reasons only. Number one, when I'm quoting from particularly hilarious and germane Supreme Court decisions and appellate court decisions. And number two, all the time during our Lord Awful movies and Patreon segments. So you have to figure out which one.
Yeah, I thought number two was going to be just all the time. Just like there's two reasons. One is this and the other is just no reason.
Well, that too. Some people tend to be amused when they first sign up on Patreon that they get the unvarnished us.
But, absolutely,
you get a little sneak preview of that in this episode. Right. But it's for a significant educational purpose. I would say let your kids listen. But that's just me. Don't take parenting advice from this podcast either.
All right. Well, first things first, there was an executive order you wanted to comment on, but we couldn't squeeze it in last week. What's going on with that?
Yeah. Donald Trump on April 10th in a non-public ceremony. So it was sort of left for people to dig this up off.
Oh, he didn't do the his usual shtick, huh? The waving around order.
Didn't do his usual shtick. Promulgated the executive order reducing poverty in America by promoting opportunity and economic mobility.
Oh my God.
Which basically is a really, really long, has multiple sections that directs his cabinet and executive agencies to find ways to gut the few remaining social programs that we have. The likely targets are the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP, which is the food stamps program, Temporary Aid to Needy Families, TANF, which is what remains of workfare, and maybe even Medicaid, which provides for payments to disabled Americans. The underlying idea is that payments should only go to those people who are willing to work. And so, you know, there's been a lot of liberal freak out about this. And I guess I want to say two things to it. Right? So number one, it's a horrible document, but we have a horrible president, right? Like it in no way should be surprising, right? We, you know, elections have consequences. This document is a statement of intent. It has zero legal effect. And the way in which you can tell, and
but I
and the way
it's
in which
reduce poverty, that's what it says.
Yeah. This is our public education lesson. If you see an executive order and it comes out and, you know, it comes out on a Monday or a Tuesday, and, you know, we're not going to get to it until Friday's show, do yourself a favor and scroll down to the bottom. This is always, right, this is a common thread in legal documents, right? Scroll down to the bottom of the executive order and see if it contains provisions like this one, which is Section 5, General Provisions, which says, A, nothing in this order shall be construed to impair or otherwise affect, one, the authority granted by law to an executive department or agency or the head thereof, or two, the functions of the Director of Office Management and Budget relating to the budgetary, administrative, or legislative proposals, B, this order shall be implemented consistent with applicable law and subject to the availability of appropriations. And C, this order is not intended to and does not create any right or benefit, substantive or procedural, enforceable at law or in equity by any party against the United States, its departments, agencies, entities, officers, employees or agents, or any other person. That's standard boilerplate that now that the Trump lawyers know how to write executive orders of saying, hey, all that stuff that just came beforehand is just red meat we're disseminating to our base so that Scott Adams can write articles about how we are the most brilliant
Another
masterminds of all time. Yeah, this is going to show up. I promise you this will show up on Scott Adams' like list of accomplishments. It is literally just words. Now, the proposals that are going to come from these words are going to be horrible proposals, and we're going to cover them. And it is why it is important, if you disagree with gutting the last remaining threads of our safety net, that you get out there and vote, and you vote for individuals who are going to fight Donald Trump's agenda. But let's do that when the proposals come down. I've seen a lot of, you know, like I said, liberal freak out already, and let's not play into that by freaking out at the statement of purpose. We know that that's the statement of purpose, right? These are the people who, you know, wanted, right? The Republican Party has not been shy about its stance on the social safety net. And, you know, now, mind you, why lots of individuals making earning below the poverty line decided to vote, you know, look, you know, our position on that is relatively clear, but this statement has no legal effect.
Okay. Yeah. It's one of those, just some words. So Donald Trump has proved that he owns a pen, and that's about as much as this has shown in terms of his accomplishment.
Top five president of all time, right? Is that what Scott Adams is saying?
Yeah,
now?
There must have been 40 other presidents that didn't have pens then, I guess. They
weren't able to... Something like that.
Yep. All right. Well, with that out of the way, covered that little pre-segment. That was a bonus. That wasn't even one of our main segments. We've got to get to the first of the lawsuits that we're going to do updates on.
Down the law. Down the law. Down the law. Down the law.
And the first one is Garza v. Hargan, the nationwide class action. What's the update on this?
Yeah, so the original case that we discussed was Jane Doe versus Wright. That was back in episode 117 with a follow-up in episode 133, and that involved the individual who was under the age of 18, arguably illegally in the country, And so we have procedures that regard detaining unaccompanied minors who are here illegally. And as a part of that process, the government was requiring these young women to attend crisis counseling, hear anti-abortion messages, undertake medically unnecessary ultrasounds. We talked about all that back in episode 117. The ACLU intervened. The courts ultimately, the full en banc DC Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled in favor of the woman, Jane Doe, and denied the government's request to stay the district court order. And then the very next day, that was October 25th, Jane Doe was able to procure her abortion, mooting that case. And then we talked about what is the likely future of that case. And, you know, we talked about how in cases involving a situation that is likely to recur, that you don't moot out the case on standing.
Yeah.
Because, right, otherwise, right, you know,
yeah,
every
you
time.
You have to time it just right to find it's not fair.
Yeah, exactly. And so the ACLU continued to conduct its investigation. They uncovered additional cases of unaccompanied immigrant minors who were nevertheless in federal government custody, according to the appropriate procedures, who were denied access to abortion by immigration officials. And so they went back to court December 15th, seeking another temporary restraining order from blocking the government from blocking these young women's access to their right to an abortion. They won the entry of a TRO on December 18th. And then remember that a TRO is designed to protect the status quo. It's designed to say, we want to make sure that nothing changes while we litigate the underlying facts. That's why you have to win. We've continued to emphasize every time we're talking about injunctive relief, in addition to irreparable harm, the primary inquiry is almost always on substantial likelihood of success on the merits. You have to make that initial showing that we are likely to win on the merits of the underlying claim. Well, that's what happens. Then you win your TRO and litigation then goes forward on the merits of the underlying claim. So that litigation was going forward. The specific women involved were not enjoined from being able to seek an abortion, and you proceeded to discovery. And in discovery, the ACLU uncovered documentary evidence of the extent of this government policy. They revealed, for example, that the determination of one of the young women that was, quote, not in her best interests, as adjudicated by the governmental agency, for her to seek an abortion, despite the fact that the pregnancy was the result of rape, and that both her mother and the person who was to serve as her sponsor threatened to beat this woman if she had an abortion, and that the young woman herself was contemplating self-harm if she was not able to obtain the abortion. That was all part of the records that came out in discovery. And so the ACLU looked at this and said, boy, this seems to be a much bigger problem than we thought from the folks who had contacted us. And so what they did was they sought to amend their complaint to bring it not only on behalf of the individual women, but as a class action on behalf of all women similarly situated. Wow. That is, unaccompanied minors in U.S. custody because their legal status here is questioned, is being challenged as not being legally in this country. That class was certified on March 30th. Of 2018. And we have talked about how that's a significant hurdle to
right,
overcome.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. In order to certify a class, what a court has to be convinced of, this is Federal Rule 23, generally they have to be convinced that the members of the class have much more in common than they do have individually. Right?
Yeah, so
in other words,
the kind of thing that won't happen for the James Damore lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly right. and think about that like, you know, one of the ways in which this has been used, you know, to keep plaintiffs out of court are mass tort lawsuits, right? So if you think about movies, popular culture, things you think about like, oh, hey, look, you know, this nuclear power plant has been burying toxic waste in people's mm-hmm. backyards. And, you know, there are a million people that are potentially affected. We're going to get together class action and we're going to sue them all, you know, on in one class and get a single adjudication. That's precisely the kinds of cases in which you can't get class certification, because how that nuclear waste affects each of the million residents is much more individualized than it is generalized, right? Asbestos cases, all of those asbestos cases are not class action cases. They are often hundreds, thousands, or tens of thousands of plaintiffs aggregated together, but they're all brought individually. And again, because the idea is that the individual claims predominate over the, right. So the commonality.
This is something that there's some misconception on. It seems like all of those things, even having done this show with you, I still would have probably offhandedly referred to those as class action type things, but they're not.
Yeah. And so it is significant that the district court has said, we think this kind of case, we think the fundamental harm here is a deprivation of your constitutional rights. And we think that that harm, which is then the same across the entire members of the class, predominates over the individual questions of, does this woman get a sponsor, right? Because you may recall in our original discussion on Jane Doe versus Wright, we talked about how the government's position was, well, just give us a little bit more time. This is about finding her a sponsor and a guardian that will be in their care and all of that sort of thing. And the court has said, yeah, you know what? We're not buying that. This is not about particularized to each individual circumstance. This is about a governmental policy that is designed to implement pro-life beliefs on a sub on a category of individuals who are under the complete control of the government, and they're not having any of it. So another kind of example of, you know, where we're making some progress. I should add parenthetically, we did get a question after we did episode 133. It remains the case that regardless of whether you were here legally or illegally, that you have basic constitutional rights in this country. And if you have an Uncle Frank who is like, well, I don't care, you know, illegal alien, the reason that you have the right to remain silent and the right to be accused of the charges against you are due to cases from illegal aliens who were not informed of those rights. So it is significant that there are some rights that inhere with citizenship, but there are other rights that inhere in the basis of being a person and being within the ambit of the government. And if you have an Uncle Frank, like, push back again and say, hey, look, the whole point of articulating rights is to constrain the power of the government. Are you really saying that you think the government should, that what controls whether the government has the right to torture you, has the right to engage in unconstitutional conduct, is the legal status of the person against whom they're doing it? Or should it be a constraint against the government itself? So
questions you'd think would be obvious, but were not in the wake of 2016. But
correct.
There you go. Good. So good work by the ACLU, right? I mean, this is something of a victory so far.
Yep, absolutely. So awesome. we'll continue to monitor. But we said we were monitoring the Jane Doe case, and we are. And
excellent.
That's where it is.
Our next update comes from Colby V. Hogan. What's the update here?
Yeah. So way back in episode 47,
over a year ago.
Yeah, it is. I made a prediction. We entitled the episode, "Is This the Gun Control Case That Could Overrule DC versus Heller?" Using that language colloquially, obviously the Fourth Circuit cannot overrule the Supreme Court.
Right.
But I made the prediction that said that this is really kind of the way forward in terms of distinguishing and marginalizing the broad sweeping language of DC versus Heller. DC versus Heller, as we have stated at great length was the 2008 decision in which Justice Scalia crafted out of whole cloth an imaginary history of half of the Second Amendment and used it to strike down a 30-year-old gun ban that everybody knew was perfectly legitimate, and somehow convinced four members of the Supreme Court to go along with it. We've had the questions about, you know, what can we do to overrule D.C. v. Heller? And I said, when Colby v. Hogan came out, I said, this is really the path forward. And Colby v. Hogan involved Maryland's ban on semi-automatic assault weapons and large capacity magazines. And the Fourth Circuit said that that was nevertheless constitutional and that it was consistent with D.C. v. Heller. How did they get there? They set up a two-step inquiry, and they this is what I really love about the decision, and part of why I flagged it as, I think, potentially being a landmark case, that they drew the test from the language of DC versus Heller itself. And it provides kind of my view of the best way to combat right-wing judicial activism. If you're going to radically change the landscape, you must find some way to square your radical new explanation of what you think the law is with the prior landscape, right? And so in DC v. Heller, what they had to do was they had to say, okay, we know that the handful of, you know, I shouldn't say handful, that the singular Supreme Court case and the handful of U.S. District and U.S. Circuit Courts of Appellate cases that were allowed to stand over the years stood for, at minimum, the propositions that it does not violate the Second Amendment for the federal government to ban machine guns, fully automatic weapons, and sawed-off shotguns, right? So how can you square that with, you know, 11 pages of Antonin Scalia talking about the history and importance of the Second Amendment?
Well, wasn't it his own language that he... Is this where you mentioned that he said, well, of course, you know, certain military weapons, we can ban those, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So he made the sarcastic statement of that, well, obviously, you know, weapons that are military weapons don't fall under the Second Amendment. So those cases aren't helpful when we're talking about a case that does fall under the Second Amendment. So what the Supreme and Scalia meant it as a throwaway line. There is no doubt in my mind that it was meant as a throwaway line. But the Fourth Circuit seized on that and said, okay, look, Scalia tells us in DC v. Heller, what's the first step of the inquiry? Does the Second Amendment cover this kind of weapon or does it not? And what's the test? Is it like a military weapon? Well, if it's like a military weapon, then it's not implicated by the Second Amendment at all. And so it is perfectly legitimate for the government to restrict that. That's the only way that you can square the result that Scalia read, right? Scalia, he just told us that the Second Amendment was wide-ranging. Well, how can it be wide-ranging and still ban an entire category of weapons? Oh, it must be because it doesn't apply. Then the second part of the test, assuming that the Second Amendment does apply, the question is, what standard do we apply for how we enforce that right? And here, keep in mind that just because government action violates or burdens your constitutional rights doesn't mean that that's the end of the inquiry. It doesn't mean that that the government is prohibited from doing anything that burdens your rights. It means that you have to figure out what level of scrutiny that we apply to that burden on your rights. And it ranges from the least intrusive, which is the rational basis test, which says that the government must articulate a purpose that is a legitimate government interest that is rationally related to the means by which the government employs to further that purpose. And a really good example of the rational basis test, the ones that if you're attempting to stick it to Scalia, would be Employment Division versus Smith, right? In that case, Scalia said, yes, laws that prohibit people from smoking or ingesting peyote do indeed incidentally burden the religion of people who believe that ingesting peyote is part of their religious beliefs, but The only question you have to ask is there a rational basis for it, right? Is there a legitimate government interest? Is the law of neutral applicability? Are we not targeting only religious peyote users? If we are, then yeah, okay, we've burdened your rights, but we've met the burden for to justify that burden on your rights. That's rational basis. At the far other end is strict scrutiny, right? That is the... has the government articulated a compelling governmental interest, and has it articulated means that are narrowly tailored, that are the least intrusive means that it can use to advance that compelling governmental interest? As we previously described, the rational basis test means that a law will almost always be upheld. The strict scrutiny standard means that a law will almost certainly be denied. Will be struck down. In the middle is what we call intermediate scrutiny.
Right.
That is, and that test uses the language, are the means reasonably adapted to a substantial government interest? And that then becomes on a case-by-case basis, on a factual basis. So without picking one of the tests, Scalia used strict scrutiny in DC versus Heller. And again, his justification is kind of a throwaway line. Right. He says banning all handguns would take away, quote, the quintessential self-defense weapon. Right. End of quote. Yeah. Right. So, again, Colby versus Hogan drew the second standard of the test from it. It said, OK, so we figure out first, is it part of the Second Amendment? And then second, we figure out what standard do we use to apply? Well, if we're banning an entire category of weapons that are the quintessential self-defense weapon, then that triggers this heightened scrutiny. But if we're banning a lesser subset than that, then it doesn't trigger strict scrutiny. It would, by definition, trigger only an intermediate form of scrutiny.
I gotta say, this is the law at its worst. I mean, it's when we're having to take Scalia's dumbass rulings and find a way that you can weave them together to make something that was obviously how it should have been. Like, back, you've playing all these word games to like try to mitigate some of the damage he did. In order, I mean, it's frustrating. I'm sorry, I can't help but express some frustration at what he did to the Second Amendment.
No, I'm really glad you shared that, because, you know, as a lawyer, like, I'm used to sort of parsing the difference between, you know, do we want to say that this is a substantial government interest, or is it a compelling government interest? Right. And, yeah. and I get that why. I mean, it's a good way of kind of bringing back to one of the premises of opening arguments, right? That, you know, I say all the time, it's not about magic words, but the flip side of that is, sometimes there are magic words, right? Sometimes there are words that have meaning. And the difference between saying it must meet a compelling governmental interest and it must meet a substantial government interest is the difference between you always losing and the difference between you sometimes winning. So, right. You know, I get that. And I guess what I would say is, in my view, if we want to maintain the notion that even bad constitutional decisions nevertheless have some value to them, nevertheless are command some level of respect, then this is sort of what we're left with, is we're left with a kind of scurrying to figure out how to make things workable in a regime that has this bad law in the background. It remains an option to say, nope, sorry, this just rises to the level of we made a mistake, right? That
yeah,
this is like Brown versus Board of Education saying, yeah, Plessy v. Ferguson, there's no way to square that anymore. Separate is inherently unequal. And, you know, and as I have said before, you know, I come down pretty strongly on the side of respect for stare decisis. But I get, you know, I get what you're saying. And I don't know that this is an area where, in my view, there are no great answers. So the question is, you know, how do we do the least amount of damage to our system of laws? I will add parenthetically that prior to the rise of Scalia-style originalism on the Supreme Court in the 1990s to today, that the the principal critics of the view that I have espoused on this show time and time again, that jurisprudence is to be guided by stare decisis, the principal critics of that were critics on the left. I took a class from Randall Delgado called Critical Legal Studies. He was one of the founding scholars of that movement who were giving some voice to what you were saying, right? A kind of, let's not pretend that there is a capital T, capital L, the law, like, you know, that has a real, let's admit what we have, that legal decisions are the product of fallible human judges with real biases, and let's tackle that directly. So if there are listeners, maybe we'll do a deep dive on this on a forthcoming Tuesday. But if our listeners are nodding along with you in frustration, then I would point you to Critical Legal Studies. That's an interesting, it's an interesting topic for debate. I come out on the other side, but you know, look, it's, I also think it's fun for me to be to the right of you and some of our listeners. So, all right. So, but that was Colby versus Hogan. And I said, I think this is going to be really a landmark case and is really going to give guidance to other cases in terms of
right, how, so this is where we find out the thrilling conclusion. Was Andrew wrong or right? Yeah. Which segment are we doing here?
Yeah, this is a right. This is the this is the District Court for Massachusetts, which just upheld Massachusetts' ban on semi-automatic assault rifles and large capacity magazines, and did so directly applying Colby versus Hogan, and did so in a way that is hilarious. I'm going to link the opinion in the show notes. If, like us, you enjoy sticking it to Scalia, you will love the fact that this opinion throughout says things like, Justice Scalia wrote for the 5-member majority in Heller, and his opinion is a tour de force example of his original meaning jurisprudence. The Second Amendment, he explained, is comprised of a prefatory clause, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, and an operative clause, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Speaking for the Supreme Court, he went to offer extensive historical grounding for this interpretation. Well aware that he was writing more than two centuries after the words the Supreme Court was interpreting had been adopted as part of our Constitution, he carefully defined the words bear and arms, giving them the meaning those words bore at the time of the Second Amendment's adoption. And so that preface is a way of saying, well, look, like, you can't come along and rehabilitate D.C. v. Heller by saying that, oh, the, you know, like weapons of war was just throwaway land. After all, I mean, Scalia said he was going through a careful history. So I thought that was particularly clever. What I really, really liked in the articulation of how the two-prong test applied to Massachusetts' ban on assault rifles and high-capacity magazines is that they used Scalia's own words against him, where the plaintiffs had attempted to argue that this assault weapons ban banned the AR-15, and the AR-15 is, you know, one of the most popular weapons that are out there, right? And so here's how the Massachusetts court dealt with that. They said, AR-15s are weapons that are based on designs of weapons that were first manufactured for military purposes. Totally true. Therefore, right, doesn't apply under the like M16 rifles test. And again, they quote to Colby. And I'm going to read this directly because, again, this is not typical for a judge's opinion. But wait, argue the plaintiffs. The AR-15 is an extraordinarily popular firearm. Indeed, the data they proffer as to its popularity appears unchallenged by the defendants. Thus, they argue that the act must fall as unconstitutional as it, quote, amounts to a prohibition of an entire class of arms that is overwhelmingly chosen by American society for a lawful purpose, and then quote to Heller. Yet, the AR-15's present-day popularity is not constitutionally material. This is because the words of our Constitution are not mutable. They mean the same today as they did 227 years ago when the Second Amendment was adopted. The test is not whether the AR-15's present-day popularity, but whether it is a weapon, quote, most useful in military service. Indeed, as Justice Scalia was most fond of reminding his audiences, And then there's a long block quote. Our attitude today is that if something ought to be so, then why the Constitution, the embodiment of all that is good and true and beautiful, requires it. And we fight out these battles about what the law ought to be, not in the democratic forum, but in the law courts. Just beautiful. There's long, I could read, there's a page and a half of block quoting to articles written by Antonin Scalia. Really, really brilliant twists in the knife. So that's the furtherance. I should have also flagged for our listeners that Colby v. Hogan was appealed to the Supreme Court, that the petitioners in that case filed a petition for certiorari. That was denied on November 27th of 2017. So the Colby v. Hogan is good law by the Fourth Circuit. And the reason that, and there's only one reason why the Supreme Court would have denied cert in that case, and that is that the activist wing that would have otherwise wanted to strike down Colby v. Hogan as, misreading the principles set forth in D.C. v. Heller, that they didn't think that they were going to get a fifth vote for it.
Wow. Well, so that's good.
Yeah. Because it only takes, remember that it only takes four votes for cert, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would think it wouldn't be hard.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Yeah. And so I think the decision was made that said, we don't want to risk this, because if it comes out of the Supreme Court, that then you have effectively overruled D.C. v. Heller, if you drastically curtail the scope. And a Supreme Court justice writing a majority opinion could very easily say, this part of the opinion was hyperbolic language, right? Could Justice Scalia, we were perhaps incautious in our description of the Second Amendment as X, right? So you're opening up a bit of a can of worms if you take it up. Now, if the balance of the Supreme Court shifts further, that calculation would change. But now you have to think about how you would get to the Supreme Court. And the way in which you would get to the Supreme Court is you're going to need an opinion like the Colby versus Hogan, right, coming out of one of the circuits. The principal way in which you demonstrate that a case is cert-worthy is by showing that there is a conflict among the circuits, right? That mm-hmm. is that in the Fourth Circuit has said that the Second Amendment does not prohibit a state from banning semi-automatic assault weapons and large capacity magazines. And another circuit would then need to have a case coming out the opposite way, right? Would need to say, yes, the Second Amendment in light of Heller does ban a state from prohibiting.
Right.
Right. So think about what you would need to get there. What you would need is a conservative circuit, right, like the 5th or the 11th, striking down a ban on semi-automatic weapons and or large mm-hmm. capacity magazines under the Second Amendment. But almost all of the states that fall within those conservative circuits are themselves conservative states, right? So Alabama is probably not going to pass a semi-automatic assault weapons ban.
Oh, interesting.
Right? Yeah. So
wow, I never thought about that. I was wondering where you're going, because I was like, yeah, that seems obviously they would strike down a ban, but why would there be such a ban?
Exactly.
That would be some next level what is the word? It would be, I wouldn't put it past conservatives to realize that they need to ban stuff they want in order to strike down a ban somewhere else. That's a tough one, even for dastardly conservatives.
Yep. And you would have to explain to the National Rifle Association why they shouldn't ding your A rating for voting for this gun ban.
Oh, man. So that's so diabolical.
Yeah. So the best candidates that I can come up with are the state of Minnesota is within the Eighth Circuit, but the Eighth Circuit isn't hugely conservative, right? It's not as conservative as the 5th or the 11th. And Florida is within the 11th. Keep your eyes on the state legislature in Minnesota and in Florida. We're going to
You had that. Me and you lost me, because I mean, Florida is where we're seeing all the activism now that could result in a
some sort of ban, and then this very scenario could happen. So while it was hilarious a minute ago, I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
Well, but I think it's worth going through the thought process of getting us there. So there you have it. Again, best way to guarantee that is to make sure that the Supreme Court does not drift further right. So, you know, if you're friends with Anthony Kennedy, make sure that you persuade him not to retire. If you're friends with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, encourage her to drink a lot of water and exercise regularly. And that's all we can do because if Trump gets another seat on the Supreme Court, then they don't need Anthony Kennedy. They can take up a case, even if there's absolutely, no doubt and no conflict among the circuits, to clarify that they got it wrong in applying the holding of DC v. Heller. But we really are on that cusp.
Wow. It's good law. Andrew was right. All right. And finally, our third case that we're going to give an update. You might have guessed that since we haven't used any profanity so far, that there's a good chance this is our profanity case, and it's an update about the slants.
Yeah. So we covered the slants case twice in 08-33, so a year and a half ago. One of our first interviews, actually, was with Simon Tan, who's the founder of the slants. And he was a terrific interview, and we covered it again when he won at the Supreme Court in opening arguments, episode number 80. What Simon Tam had wanted to do was trademark his band name, The Slants. The Slants is an offensive racial stereotype involving Asian Americans. And Simon, who is Asian American, got together a band of other Asian Americans, and they were sort of trying to reclaim the offensive language in much the same way that the queer movement has successfully reclaimed the word queer. So that was the goal. His effort to trademark the band's name, The Slants, was denied by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office under 15 U.S.C. section 1052A, which provides that the office may refuse to register a trademark that consists of or comprises immoral, deceptive, or scandalous matter, or matter which may disparage or falsely suggest a connection with persons, living or dead, institutions, beliefs, national symbols, or bring them into contempt or disrepute. The slants registry was denied on the basis of that second half, that it was disparaging. And so they refused to register the trademark. Simon Tam went all the way to the Supreme Court. Mattel versus Tam reversed and struck down that second half of 2A, said that allowing the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to deny trademark protection to marks that, quote, may disparage, end quote, was viewpoint discrimination under the First Amendment. That left intact, and we then opined, okay, so what's going to happen to cases that fall under the other half, right? That were brought under the immoral, deceptive, or scandalous clause, right? And I should add, apparently, that the history involving those words are, this is like cruel and unusual punishment, right? Immoral and scandalous are not treated separately. It's all kind of treated under the same sort of general area, which is immoral and scandalous. And so there was no argument that slants was immoral and scandalous. There was an argument that it was disparaging. So next case to challenge the first prong of that is a case called In Re Brunetti. And Mr. Brunetti owns a clothing company that uses the brand. And this is where our explicit comes in.
Cover your ears, kids.
It is the clothing brand FUCT, which is pronounced fucked. And so he's been selling fucked clothing since 1990. And in 2011, he applied for trademark protection on various items of clothing, and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office denied that protection under the same Section 2A, but under the first clause, finding that it comprised immoral or scandalous matter. And this is, again, I'm reading from the opinion itself. The examining attorney reasoned that F-U-C-T is the past tense of the verb fuck, a vulgar word, and is therefore scandalous. Brunetti appealed, and that went all the way up to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which hears all of these cases. It is, again, like the 11th, 4th, right, like the other circuit courts of appeal. It is one step away from the Supreme Court. And that court ruled that Section 2A, that the provisions preventing the U.S. Patent Trademark Office from acknowledging, recognizing trademarks that are immoral or scandalous is similarly void as against the First Amendment as the second half of the clause. So now we know that the entirety of 2A is null and void. I will point out that this opinion, which I am going to link, is delightful. And so if you would like to know the Urban Dictionary history of F-U-C-T, I encourage you to go ahead and read it. It's hilarious. It is the lengthiest description of the various tenses of the verb that you will ever see from a federal court. So I put that out there, but that closes up that loophole and makes it clear that there was no basis under Section 2A for denying trademark protection to immoral or scandalous trademarks in the same way that you may not deny protection to trademarks that may tend to disparage an individual or group of persons. So there you go. Register away all of your vulgar trademarks while you can.
Wow.
How?
I love it. There is so much who's on first potential with that company. Ah, these clothes are fucked up.
Can I share my favorite one? As long as we're in the already explicit segment, we just witnessed a really fantastic Super Bowl. And after the Super Bowl.
Yes, we did.
Because
the Patriots lost.
The Patriots lost, and the Super Bowl MVP was Nick Foles. He threw three touchdowns, caught another one. Right, it was amazing, right? And
it was crazy.
And so two folks watching the Super Bowl decided that they wanted to trademark a phrase that would help them cash in on the new attention that was being brought to Nick Foles in light of his Super Bowl performance. And that's the phrase, Big Dick Nick. It is, as my reading of their trademark application, which I have done, lets me know, not just a clever rhyme. It is, in fact, based on evidence in the record from former Eagles players who have testified that Mr. Foles does indeed apparently have the largest penis on the Eagles.
Ah, so there was some discovery on this one.
Yeah, it's in their application that Nick Foles apparently
fact finding
has an enormous penis, one of the two gentlemen who is applying for the trademark says, this was in an interview with Deadspin, "Let me be honest with you. I'm a Falcons fan. I didn't think the Eagles were going to win the Super Bowl, but as it looked like they might, we came up with the idea. So we wanted to trademark Big Dick Nick. It is, quote, a phrase that really seems to resonate with people even before the Super Bowl." So they sell a whole bunch of merchandise with the phrase Big Dick Nick on it.
Oh, I wonder what their logo is.
Including a beach towel. And now there is no 2A bar, right? Previously, this would have absolutely been denied by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. But now there is no bar simply because of the potentially offensive or scandalous nature of the trademark. There is an obstacle. Subsection C bars you from registering as a trademark something that identifies a particular person without the consent of that person. And the most famous case in that is a company that was trying to trademark the Obama pajama. But so the question is,
did they get Nick's permission?
They have not gotten Nick's permission. It very likely is not Nick's permission to give the uniform contract.
Oh, it's his dick. They have to get his
dick.
Oh.
it's probably all IP rights are owned by the Eagles. So, for example, there's a related case, if you recall that trick play where Foles himself went out as the receiver, they were calling it the Philly Special. And immediately after the Super Bowl, Yingling, which is a beer manufacturer located in Pennsylvania, tried to trademark the Philly Special, and they wound up pulling their application because the Eagles also filed a trademark for Philly Special so that they can sell shirts with it. So I do not think, however, it is likely that the Eagles are going to want to file a trademark application for Big Dick Nick. So the question will be whether it hits that standard of it's identifying a person, and that we could go into the specifics on how that test gets applied. None of you care. You just wanted to hear me talk about Big Dick Nick and fucked clothing. But now I have.
And also, I think what's so funny is after the game, you know, Nick Foles was like, you know, his all his praise went to Jesus and he's going to become a pastor. he's going to be the nation's only pastor with a nickname like Big Nick. Big Dick Nick.
Well, you know, presumably
that'll be one to answer, you know, when the kids ask, why is our pastor named Big Dick Nick? It's kind of a,
you know, all things considering there's certainly worse nicknames you could be stuck with, but there you go. So feel free.
The Lord giveth.
Apparently. Anyway. So feel free to go out and register all of those highly offensive trademarks. And in fact, if you want a law firm that registers highly offensive trademark, send me an email. I do in fact register trademarks. So hadn't intended to use that as a commercial, but there we go.
Right. There you have it. Okay. Well, good updates. Doesn't sound like you were wrong about anything in particular, really. These are all pretty much a positive episode,
right? Yeah, I feel good about it.
All right, good stuff. Well, you heard it here first, and you always hear it here first because Andrew's the best. And also, the show goes on because of our kind patrons at patreon.com/law. And it's time for our co-favorite segment of the week when we've got to thank our new patrons.
I love and new patrons Tuesday.
Isn't it like the top two easily? I mean, it's one or two. I'm not sure which in terms of segments. It just consists.
It's one and one and one delivers. A. I agree with that.
There you go. And thanks go to Goonie Goon Goon, Andrew Payne, Sheena K. Rocia. I don't know. Sorry. Bob Brown. How long can this thing be and have Thomas read it? Can I copy and...
There you go. That's how long.
So a lot shorter than probably what you wanted is the answer to that question. Chris Sio, Jeremiah Holzbauer, Steven Rogers, Richard Lindgren, Matthew Reiger, Maslab, Stacy Startzel, adopt a homeless yodeler and oppose falling off cliffs.
Good.
Jockel Carter, Steven Skinner, Dan Richardson, Kelly Stidoff, Liam Hannon. Rational humans should eat little to no meat. Rigoberto Garcia, E Pluribus Unum, and James English. Thank you, folks, so much.
I'm a little sad that you didn't read that as E Pluribus Unum, but we'll give him a shout out both ways.
Hey, well, I have a responsibility to represent our patrons' names as to the best of my ability.
And I will share in that solemn duty. So thank you to Samuel Jennings, Benjamin Gilson, Thomas Williams, Dylan McDowell, Matt Collins, turned down for Angor Watt. Good one. Luis Woolham. Thank you to Elena Cathoria, to Ellie Flanagan. Thanks to Ron Thomas, Vito J. Marzano, Derek Dusablon, SR89, Colin Stewart, Daniel Willett, John Glassley, Molly Bowling, Rick Talbot. Thank you to Bigglesby, Lafferty, Patty O'Flaherty, Mickey O'Malley, Cat Shea. That's a thing. Samantha Oliver, Thanks to Alex and Sandy want Andrew to draft their prenup. No, you do not. And thanks to Charles S. Herrera. Thanks to all of you. We really, really appreciate your support. Like we say, we couldn't do this show without the support of patrons. So if you want to join their ranks, get all our great free stuff, illustrate how much you love, support the show, head on over patreon.com/law, sign on up, and we will read whatever you tell us to read in this segment. Come on, you know you want to do it.
Awesome. Thank you, folks, so much.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time to find out the thrilling conclusion of TTTBE. Very difficult question. Let's see how I did.
Yeah, this is, I think, the toughest question we've had. And super, super interesting. So it's a question about in-state, let's call that state California. I don't know why they didn't give the state a name in the, in the actual question.
I know, like that's going to be that hard to just name.
And usually
state,
they do, they'll give it, they'll be like the state of, you know, Massachusetts or whatever.
Oh, it'll be some fake one. Yeah. It's like, what's okay.
So
anyway, are they trying not to confuse people with like actual state
law? That's probably right. They wanted to focus. This is a question of constitutional law and in particular, two provisions that probably our listeners, have little to no exposure to. So, inside California, there's a company that's developed this Martian toy. That's a high quality toy that, is a virtual reality. You run the vehicle and it shows the landscape. It sounds really, really cool. Seems like a good idea. And the state, but that sells for, let's say it's $100 a pop. And now all of a sudden the state is being inundated with these out of state companies that are selling cheap knockoffs, for $20 a pop that, that don't accurately depict the Martian landscape. And the question is, can the state of California enact a requirement that forbid the sale of any toy that purports to represent extraterrestrial objects and does not satisfy specified scientific criteria? In other words, can they pass a law preventing you from selling the out-of-state knockoffs in the state of California in order to protect the business within the state of California? Let's just kind of work through the way you worked it through. So the first answer that you eliminated was, that the law is unconstitutional because it abrogates the obligations of the contracts between other toy manufacturers and the in-state outlets that have agreed to sell their toys. And you said, yeah, that doesn't seem like that would be a constitutional thing. And actually,
yeah, like whether or not there were contracts doesn't seem like it would impact whether or not this is constitutional.
Right. And so I will tell you, it's a good elimination, but actually Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution is called the Contracts Clause. And it says no state shall, and then gives a whole bunch of things that states can't do. They can't enter into a treaty, alliance, confederation. They can't coin money, blah, blah, blah. No state shall do any of those things or pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts.
And
so you might be...
Well, how did I luck into that then? Just because it wasn't the best answer?
Here's why. Because you're probably sitting there thinking, well, all the laws that states do seem to impair obligations under contracts. Yeah. That's absolutely correct. And so beginning with the end of the Lochner era and the beginning of the New Deal, the Supreme Court said, we're going to interpret this clause under the rational basis test. Right, under the most expansive definition possible. And so what it means is that the state is only prohibited from impairing a contract where they cannot articulate a rational government basis and that the means of impairing that contract are reasonably related to that rational basis. And as I said before, almost everything passes that test. It is sometimes called the fogged mirror test, right? If you
Okay, so there's enough of a rational basis for that not to be.
And
concerned.
So here there is the contracts clause, but so long as the laws are reasonably related to a legitimate state interest, then courts will defer to state regulations, even though they might impair the burdens under private contracts. And so
Well, I lucked into that one, didn't I?
Yeah. Okay. So, yes, it is legitimate for the state to say we want to ensure that people have, that our kids have accurate science, right? And that's enough for it to pass the contract clause, Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. Next, you eliminated C. Yes, because it deals only with a local matter, which is the sale of toys located stores within the state. And you said that that doesn't seem right. That seems like an overly technical view. And I want to tell you that is exactly the correct analysis of C. We now move to a slightly different provision in Article 1 of the Constitution, which is Article 1, Section 8, which says that Congress shall have the power to do a whole bunch of different stuff. But one of the things that Congress shall have the power to do is called the Commerce Clause. Article 1, Section 8 specifies that the U.S. Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes, right? So interstate commerce is exclusively the jurisdiction of the U.S. Congress and does not
right. So basically the state can't get away with regulating that by saying, well, no, we're just talking about within our state because it's impacting interstate commerce.
That's exactly right. And that doctrine had to develop through stare decisis, through later Supreme Court cases, right? Because if you just take the plain meaning of the terms, you would say, yeah, look, like that says Congress gets to regulate interstate commerce. It doesn't say states may not do X. But what the Supreme Court determined over time is that, and this is often called the negative commerce clause. It says, if we say the exclusive domain of regulating interstate commerce is to fall on Congress, then a fortiori, right, if a state does something that has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, it's taking away a power that belongs explicitly to the Congress. And rationally speaking, you can understand that, right?
Right. You know, I lucked into A, but I actually think I had the right thinking on this elimination. So, all right.
I think that's exactly right. So now it comes down to the question B, which was your answer, the law is not constitutional because it imposes an undue burden on interstate commerce, or D, yes, because the state's interest in protecting children from faulty science justifies this burden on interstate commerce. And I will tell you, you eliminated D. Good elimination. The Commerce Clause gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the states, and the negative implication restricts the regulatory power of the states with respect to interstate commerce. Any state law that has a substantial effect on interstate commerce must not be protectionist, must not impose an undue burden on interstate commerce. And it is very, very clear that this law is designed to protect an in-state manufacturer from out-of-state knockoff competition. Right, I made it a little bit more clear in the explanation, right? Because I didn't want to bias you while you were answering the question, Cole.
No, I got it. I understood.
Yeah,
no,
of course, because you got the right answer. But now think about this.
Well, no, I understood the concept though. I lucked out in guessing. Well, no. I thought that the and let me know if I had the wrong reasoning, but it just seemed like this is such a weak justification. You know, like. A toy, the map on a toy, it just seemed too minor. But is that why, or would any justification have not been adequate to do this particular law?
So you are, again, exactly correct that the justification is insufficient to justify the fact that that this clearly has a discriminatory effect on out-of-state business, right? Which is not to say you could never do it, but that has to meet the strict scrutiny standard, right? You're going to have to show that there is a compelling state interest and that the means are the least restrictive means necessary to achieve that compelling state interest. Look, could you do that? Sure, right? Like if suppose the toy manufacturer is, you know, complying with laws. And we have evidence that all of the out-of-state manufacturers are using slave labor or something like that, right? Like, you know, I mean, it's not a typically likely scenario, but right. You always need to justify. The question is the standard by which you are justifying the intrusion upon rights. And here, the standard is plainly not sufficient when it is obvious that that really what this law is meant to do is to protect an in-state business from out-of-state competition. You could imagine if that were the case, particularly as our nation was developing, then, you know, you would have, you know, potential trade wars between states, right?
Yeah.
And so it is kind of crucial for the operating of a modern advanced economy that we don't have regulations between states that privilege in-state business at the expense of out-of-state business. It's the negative implications of the Commerce Clause. It's a really, really neat and narrow decision that most lawyers don't come into contact with on a daily basis or even on a career basis after studying for the bar.
Well, hot damn, I nailed this one.
You did fantastic.
This test is too easy. I'm going to get back up to 100%. I'm going to answer somehow 30 additional questions.
I guess we need to do a follow-up of Thomas Takes Math Exam. But no, I'm going to have to find a harder question. You're too good.
Well, you know, you don't have to do that. I enjoy being able to get slightly over 50% of them correct, which is not that great.
No, it's great. And again, I really like the fact that, I mean, yeah, there was a bit of a distinction on the constitutional provision, but again, right, your common sense analysis got there, right? Which was, if there is, you know, missed that there was a constitutional provision, but if there is such a provision, it obviously
was. I just didn't know there was one for the contract.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right. On the okay. contracts yeah, thing. Yeah. Right.
No, I know. I remember learning a little bit about interstate commerce in my business law class, but not. I don't think that's what helped me with the question. I think it's just the experience of, you know, us talking about what is an actual justification for something like this. And I just didn't feel like it was. So plus, as always, a fair helping of luck. But with that said, who is our big winner who we're going to shower with fame and fortune? Andrew, hop in your time machine and tell us who the winner is for this week.
All right.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas, we had a lot of folks play along with this one, and we had answers, I think, evenly split between B, C, and D. One person rather humorously guessed A, saying, I don't see any other A answers out there, so if it's right, I want to be the one who wins. Great strategy, but as you know, B is correct. And this week's winner is going to be Donald Wizenhunt. At Donald112 on Twitter, who says, I think Thomas is right, B, but it did not seem that hard, so clearly this must be wrong. Well, no, maybe Donald, maybe you're just that smart. So everyone give at Donald112, Donald Wizenhunt, a follow on Twitter. Congratulations on winning this week's fiendishly hard TTTBE.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you most of all to Andrew for Andrewing. And for our patrons for patronizing us, you are the best, and you're the reason the show keeps on going, and I can't wait to see what Friday has in store. Just quick note, I may be recording, you know, on location or something, so my audio could be a little different, or depressingly, maybe it won't sound any different. Which would be depressing for me because I have such a elaborate recording setup and I'm going to be using a cheap USB microphone. So if they sound the same, I will be a little depressed. But anyway, with that all said, we will see you on Friday.
Until then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.